Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal Appeal. Pope Benedict prays for help for the victims of fires in the Russian Federation and of the devastating floods in Pakistan and Afghanistan. At his general audience, he also speaks to over 50,000 young altar servers from across Europe who are on a pilgrimage to Rome. Niger, an unfolding catastrophe. Over 200,000 children in Niger are suffering from severe malnutrition. And we hear the latest on the nation's worsening food crisis from a Catholic aid worker who recently got back from there. And sex trade ordeal. Listen to the inspirational life story of a former prostitute who quit her job, became a Catholic, and set up a shelter to help other sex workers leave the trade and start a new life. Benedict has appealed for aid for the victims of recent natural disasters, the devastating floods in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and the widespread fires in the Russian Federation.
Il mio pensiero va alle popolazioni colpite in questo periodo.
Speaking at the end of his general audience, Pope Benedict raised a prayer and an appeal for the victims of recent national disasters, the huge fires in the Russian Federation and the devastating floods in Pakistan and Afghanistan that have killed more than 1,000 people, caused widespread destruction and left hundreds of thousands of people without homes. The Pope said he was praying for the victims of these disasters and urged the entire international community to show solidarity and come to their aid.
La solidarietà di tutti. Liebe deutschsprachige Pilger, willkommen hier in Rom.
Wednesday's general audience in St. Peter's Square was the Pope's first since he transferred to his summer residence at Castel Gandolfo outside Rome a month ago. The square was packed out thanks to the presence of over 50,000 young altar servers from across Europe who have come to Rome on a pilgrimage and who on Tuesday attended a vast concert in St. Peter's Square that concluded with Vespers. Addressing the altar servers at his general audience, Pope Benedict urged them to carry out their duties with love, devotion and faithfulness, saying that in this way they are helping to make Jesus closer and more present in their everyday lives.
A special greeting to the English-speaking altar servers present. By serving at Mass, may you draw ever closer to Christ our Lord. Upon all of you, I invoke God's abundant blessings.
The altar servers converged on Rome this week from 12 different European countries, with the vast majority of them hailing from the Pope's native Germany. Among those who came to Rome was Father Ludwig Wallmüller, head of youth ministry for the Diocese of Augsburg in Germany, who was interviewed by Emma McCarthy.
How important do you think this action of altar service is for young people to try and help them deepen their faith? And how difficult is it to attract young people to altar service?
The number of altar servers always goes up in Germany in the last years. In our diocese, is always going up. I think for young people, it's the first possibility to stand in front of people. On the other hand, you deepen your faith because you see something, I would say, intimately, what you normally see only from a distance. And you are involved in the Eucharist. You're involved in the service on the altar. For Benedict XVI, liturgy is very, very important, especially beauty of liturgy. And here, these young people are very important for him.
That was Father Ludwig Wallmüller from the Diocese of Augsburg in Germany. An unfolding catastrophe. is how the World Food Programme has described the worsening food crisis in the African nation of Niger, where around 200,000 children are already suffering from severe malnutrition. With over 7 million people, or just under half of its population, facing food shortages, Niger lies at the centre of a food and malnutrition crisis that is affecting nearly 10 million people in the Sahel region of the continent. The food shortages are the result of a deadly combination of recurrent drought, crop failures, increases in food prices, and abject levels of poverty that have often forced people to sell or kill their starving livestock. Philippe Mougin is a senior humanitarian officer for CAFOD, the London-based Catholic Development Agency, and he recently returned from a week-long visit to Niger. He told me more about the gravity of the food crisis there.
Yes, it's a very serious crisis indeed. More than 7 million people are affected. That's nearly half of the population of the country. And among these 7 million people, 3 million people are really in desperate need of assistance. I wouldn't call it a famine, because the international community has been mobilized and millions of people receive food assistance. But for some of the badly affected families, some of these people have nothing to eat and don't receive food at all.
So when you say they're people who don't receive food at all, how are they coping? How are they surviving? Are they literally going for days without proper food?
Well, when I was in Niger, I heard people talking about surviving on whatever berries they could find, people cutting meals. Some families, they just go for some days without food. There won't be a harvest before late September, October. So we are really at the tipping point of the crisis. And for the coming weeks, there are certainly some people who have nothing to eat for some days.
And what is the physical condition like of the babies and children in this area? Did you manage to visit any rural areas? Can you describe for us or paint us a picture of how they are suffering?
Yes, children, of course, are most vulnerable and they are bearing the brunt of the crisis. CAFOD, we work with our partners on the ground, and one of the first things we did is to scale up our feeding centers. The rate of admissions in feeding centers has gone up since April, May. At some point, there were 7,000 to 8,000 children admitted in the feeding centers across the country every week.
And did you see, as you moved around, signs of children who were obviously malnourished? Is that very common amongst the population?
Yes, absolutely. When I was in Niamey, I visited one of our feeding centers, and I followed the family at their home. I know that the mother had to go to the feeding center every week. She's walking a very long distance to get to the feeding center, something like 15 kilometers every week to get the food for her children. One of the child was in a very bad condition with a kwashiorkor, which is a very acute form of malnutrition. And it's one case among many of children surviving on the food that is distributed in feeding centers.
So is there a risk that many children will die unless more aid reaches the country?
Even for children reaching the feeding centers, unfortunately, you cannot avoid completely some death in the feeding centers for the children who are in the poorest condition. But of course, most of the children who can receive treatment will be saved.
And what do the people say about these food shortages and about this hunger?
Yes, people are, desperate. They're hoping for assistance. The new government has acknowledged that there was a crisis and called on the international community for help. But unfortunately, the assistance is not enough. The World Food Programme with its partners is only reaching 2 to 3 million people out of the 7 million affected. Clearly, the regions in the eastern side of the country where most of the nomadic population is living, there is a very desperate situation with the livestock. So we consider that some areas, 60% or more of the livestock has perished.
Do you have any particular anecdotes involving either a family, an individual that you met, that can illustrate for us the plight of these people, if you could briefly tell us? about one such case?
You know, in feeding centers, you find children in a very, very poor condition, and mothers try their best to get some treatment for the children. But it's very sad to see in some families that there are children in the feeding center at the moment, but the same mom had other children who died in previous crises. So it's always heartbreaking to hear mothers saying, yes, I have got one child at the moment under treatment, receiving food, but I have had other children who were in the same condition and who have died. So these kind of stories really make you realize that it's really a tragedy.
And is the situation going to get worse before it gets better in Niger?
Well, we are literally now the tipping point of the crisis. It only started to rain a few weeks ago. All will depend on the current rainy season and the next harvest, but it's not before the end of September or beginning of October that people will start harvesting. So for the coming weeks, assistance is absolutely necessary to keep these people alive.
I was speaking to Philippe Mougin from CAFOD, who has recently returned from Niger. For an inspirational story that sprang from a somewhat unlikely beginning. Prostitution is often described as the oldest profession in the world, and it's arguably one of the most despised. But sex for money exists no matter where one goes in the world, and statistics show that in many countries, business is booming. In the UK, for instance, the number of men who frequent sex workers has nearly doubled in a decade. We hear nowadays how a growing number of those working as prostitutes are the victims of people traffickers who have forced them to become sex slaves. But what about those who have chosen this profession? What are their feelings about their job? And what is the church's response to prostitution? Well, I've been finding out more.
It was an abusive life. It was a soul-destroying life. You hate your clients. I hated doing what I did.
Linda Watson is a former prostitute turned campaigner who worked in the sex trade in Western Australia for 20 years, initially as a prostitute and then as a brothel manager or madame. After quitting her job at the brothel, she set up Linda's House of Hope, a shelter that helps other girls to leave the sex trade and start a new life. In 2003, she was named Australia's most inspirational woman by the magazine Woman's Weekly for her work on behalf of others. Linda first got lured into the sex trade by the promise of high earnings when she was an impoverished single mother struggling to support three children. She told me more about her first impressions.
My first client, I guess we always go back to the first client, was a high-profile media executive. I was quite amazed that somebody so powerful, so rich, and in such a high position. And I thought, oh, I had from the butcher to the baker right to these high-profile people. But I guess you soon learn that most of them lack integrity. 99% of them are married. And you think, wow, hey, what's marriage? There is no trust. Why would you want to get married if your man's going to go to a brothel, huh?
And what were your feelings about them? I mean, did you sometimes feel sorry for them? Did you despise them? Did you fear them?
I guess you switch on and off. I think you learn very quickly that to survive, you're going to think, I'm just doing this for the money. You know, you could be reading the paper almost. It's just such a cold transaction. So you're not really trying to focus on the person that you're with. You're focusing right at the beginning. We're going back to my beginning thinking, this will make money. I'll do this for a couple of months and I'll get out. And there lies a real danger too, where you just totally switch off.
So you never came across anybody who treated you with even a slight degree of respect?
There's a lot of people who were very, very nice. Also, I learnt that they were very insecure and, you know, I'm not a man hater. They also hated themselves for having to pay for it. I guess underneath, they had a problem. There were nice men who would talk to you. There were men who would cry because their wife didn't understand them. And so you think, oh, poor person. But really, the underlying thing is the fact that it was deceitful and they lacked integrity. That I learned very quickly, and I got very disillusioned. The reality is nothing like the Pretty Woman movie.
Linda says the sense of shame was so strong that she tried to conceal what she was doing from those around her.
I mean, I concealed it from nearly everybody that I could think of. I quickly got a nanny in. The money was rolling in. I mean, I was supposed to earn $2,000 a week. I earned $5,000 in my first week. You're certainly not going to tell your kids. But then you sort of think, right, I feel so dirty. And I remember coming home showering. Had so many showers because I felt so dirty. And I certainly lost that part of even being a mother because I even when I went to cuddle my kids, I felt so guilty. So I really did shelter them until they were old enough for me to tell them because I was really concerned that there would be somebody that would tell them.
Linda originally only intended to work as a prostitute for 2 months. But as she explains, once you get sucked into the sex trade, it's very difficult to escape.
It was very difficult to get out because the money entrapped me, the lifestyle entrapped me, and I guess I lost who I was. I lost my will, you know, my self-worth. I mean, I knew it wasn't right when I went into it. I went into a whole different sort of a world.
Drug use and prostitution each tend to fuel the other. And Linda says a very high percentage of sex workers become addicted to drugs.
98% of the girls that are working are on drugs. If they come in clean, they're certainly not going to stay clean for very long.
Why is this such a problem?
Because it's an emotional job. It's also the fact that these girls are doing 8 to 15 men a day, and some are doing 20 clients in one shift. So they are needing something to fuel their bodies so that they can continue to do the job. That actually gets them to stay in the sex industry.
But although the vast majority of prostitutes do find it very difficult to leave the sex trade, Linda was able to buck that trend. She told me how one day she decided she'd had enough and wanted to start a new life.
There was a lot of aspects for me leaving the industry. My mother's prayers, for start, she prayed for me for 20 years. She never stopped praying for me to get out of the industry. And I had so many bad experiences. And when Princess Diana died, I guess that was a pivotal moment that I thought, all the money that you can make isn't going to make you rich. I guess there was a whole pile of issues of seeing all the pain and hurt in people's eyes over 20 years and my own pain. I asked for God to help me and his guidance that night, I think August the 31st, 1997. I just said, God, if you're really there, reveal yourself to me. And I couldn't put it more clearer that I cried out for God to help, and he did.
But what was so unusual about Linda was that once she left the sex trade, she didn't forget those she'd left behind. Instead, she decided to go back and rescue others from the sex industry.
I had a passion on my heart, and I guess the other side of it as well is 20 years, who was going to employ me? I was 42 years of age, and I wasn't ready to lie down and not do anything. But I guess the defining moment was that what can I do with my life and what purpose can this serve? And I guess the biggest thing for me was that the government was about to legalise prostitution in Western Australia. And that was the pivotal moment that I sort of said, right, this isn't going to happen. And from there I had a burning passion to save others and to warn others not to do that. Don't go down that path.
But, as she told me, trying to find support and backing for her idea of opening a shelter to house former prostitutes proved incredibly difficult.
Difficult was an understatement. I had banged on doors for 2 years, and I got to the stage where I sort of went to every possible places that I could think of that I could go, and every door was closing. You know, people were starting to even laugh at the fact that I was still continuing my search for this dream or vision. And I said, I have this passion and vision that I can provide a home, I can do something for people, but everybody's shutting the doors in my face.
But one day, a door was not banged shut in her face, and Linda was given that vital helping hand.
I could not believe how he welcomed me with open arms, and he believed in me, and he believed in my vision, plus fighting against legalisation. He was an answer to my prayers.
The answer to Linda's prayers came in the person of the Catholic Archbishop of Perth, Barry Hickey. It was he who helped her to set up a shelter for former sex workers. Here's his side of the story.
Linda rang me, almost in desperation, saying, I was a madam and I pulled out of the industry and I want to rescue girls. Can you help me? I immediately said, I don't know how to help you, but I will help you.
Was it an easy thing to do? Were other people trying to dissuade you from it? I mean, how did you go about it?
Well, I waited for 2 weeks and said I'd call you back, and I did. And by then I'd resolved that if she needed accommodation, I would provide at least one house, and we've been able to do that. And now she has a second house, which is the house where the prostitutes mainly stay. But there was some surprise, a lot of surprise. Some people shook their heads and said, what's she getting into? But generally, the support has been great.
Archbishop Hickey remains actively involved in Linda's project and says through his association, his eyes have been opened to how much the sex trade exploits these women.
I visit the place every couple of months and I meet the girls that are there at any particular time. There are lots of success stories, girls being very grateful that they had a chance to escape that prison of prostitution and have a chance to do some studies, to get some skills and to get other jobs.
And what have you learned on a personal level from your involvement in this project and from your talks with these people who are trying to escape from the world of prostitution? I mean, has it sort of broken down, shall we say, some stereotypes that many of us may harbour about these women?
One of the things Linda has always said is that there is no glamour in prostitution. And I've found that out too. The lives of these girls are anything but glamorous. I've discovered that most of them have entered prostitution against their will. They themselves have been abused in many cases and have very low self-esteem. I've also found out that my opinion of men generally is not that good. They exploit these girls to cross every section of society. Most of them are unfaithful to their wives. It is not a good scene. There is a lot of exploitation also by the people who control the prostitutes. So I see it as a grimy trade, and I'm glad Linda's there rescuing these girls.
In Britain, Dr. Elaine Storkey is a well-known Christian author and sociologist who is president of the Christian development charity Tear Fund. She has done several studies on prostitution and has been involved in faith-based projects to try to rescue sex workers from the trade. Elaine believes the Christian churches often have a tendency to be too judgmental when it comes to the issue of prostitution. Instead, she says, what is required is a sense of compassion.
Why is it that they're trapped into this lifestyle? Why is it that they have so little respect for their own bodies that they're willing to use them in this kind of way? And I think just talking to women and trying to give them more self-respect and more body sense that's positive rather than negative is also what we can do. I think where we failed a lot is just simply seeing prostitutes as immoral people whom we need to legislate against and hound out of our patch. They're real human beings with great needs and often very bad backgrounds, and we need all the compassion we have to actually work with them.
Elaine told me how even a single kind gesture can succeed in reaching out to what many perceive as hardened sex workers.
There's one project in the UK in an area of London well known for prostitution where a bunch of churches decided to get together and on Christmas Eve go round all the known prostitutes in the area with a rose, a single red rose, and not with a tract and not with a complaint or anything, just with a rose to say, this is Christ's birthday, we want to share something of what we feel about Jesus Christ and with you, and then leave the rose with them and wish them a happy Christmas and go away. And one of the women who'd received a rose spoke to me, and she said it broke her heart. She had no idea that the God that the church believed in was a God who actually loved her. And she had that rose, and she said when it died, when it finally died, she just wept and wept and wept because somehow something of herself had gone into that rose. So I think a lot of women are feeling very negative about themselves in the job. A lot of them are struggling to get out. A lot are very, very defensive because they feel they're being judged by others. And then a few do feel that this is a perfectly okay lifestyle and they're going to stay with it. It's very mixed.
Returning to the situation in Australia, how does Archbishop Hickey evaluate the Catholic Church's response to prostitution? And how much help does it provide to those trying to get out of the business?
I would say that only on an individual level is much else being done. Occasionally a prostitute will approach a priest or a convent for help, but that is rare. I think Linda's project in this part of the world is the main contribution that the church is making by supporting her.
So, in your view, a lot more could and should be done?
Yes, I think government and the community generally should support efforts to rescue these girls. The scene here is very different from trafficking that goes on in third world countries or from third world countries to Europe. We have some trafficking here, but not much. Most of the prostitution is by local girls in local brothels controlled by local people.
And when it comes to the men that use prostitutes, is the church speaking out enough against the fact that they should not be doing this, that they are exploiting these women?
I do use opportunities that come my way in the media to say those things, but generally prostitution is glamorized. The image of a prostitute is one who is wealthy, who is having fun, and who wants to be where she is. It's a completely wrong picture. We're doing something, but we're not getting enough publicity, because I don't think people believe us.
When you say you don't think people believe us, what do you mean by that?
I mean that they think that if the church speaks out, it's just speaking out about outdated moral code. But when people get close to prostitutes, they see that their lives are very sad indeed. We have very little legislation, so prostitution is on the rise, but we want better legislation to control it, but not to license it.
Why is prostitution on the rise, in your opinion?
I think it's the general culture of the country, where personal freedom is emphasized to such an extent that prostitution is seen to be a man's right, and it's mainly men who look for girls. It's just part of the general culture that people can do what they like and nobody should put up any moral barriers. Also, it is not generally understood that the girls are harmed by prostitution and exploited, and that's the message we want to put out there to men.
Perhaps not surprisingly, Linda's courageous decision to help rescue girls from the sex trade has earned her many enemies among her former associates in the business. She told me how on numerous occasions she has risked death because of her stand.
When I first left the industry, I spoke to a madam and she threatened me and asked me to leave town, and this wasn't going to happen and she wasn't going to stand for it. And then I got shot at, I've been shot at, firebombed, threats, nearly kidnapped, people nearly through my roof. Can't count the death threats. It's been horrendous.
But you're carrying on.
Absolutely, absolutely. I have my dignity back and I have something worthwhile fighting for, and I believe in what I do.
But regaining her dignity and self-respect is just one of the rewards Linda has found in her new life. A Catholic convert, Linda says her greatest moment came when she met the late Pope John Paul during a visit to Italy in 2004.
Well, I met the Pope. Wow, that was just the best reward that I ever had. I just felt like, oh my God, I'm standing here right in front of the Pope and here I am. It was just like redemption for me. I just felt like Mary Magdalene standing there in front of the Pope. That was my greatest overwhelming, and of course I'd won the most inspirational woman of Australia, and that didn't mean as much as meeting the Pope.
That was the voice of Linda Watson, a former sex worker turned campaigner, and you also heard the voices of Archbishop Barry Hickey of Perth and Elaine Storkey, an expert on prostitution. Well, that's all for now from me, Susie Hodges, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow, and you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.